This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Now, do you like quizzes? Do you want to be Prime Minister? Well, good news. You can come on my Times radio show, 10 till 1, Monday to Friday, and play our hugely popular quiz, Can You Get to Number 10? It's very easy. 10 questions loosely connected to 10 cabinet jobs. The more questions you get right, the better we get, taking your place alongside our listeners and guests. It's 10 general knowledge questions. The more you get right, you get a job in the cabinet, you could end up as Prime Minister. Who wouldn't want to do that? Particularly wise Redbox listeners. Email me, matt.chorley@times.radio, with your name and your number, and we can get you on very soon. Now, coming up on today's episode, we're talking guns. It's now been 3 weeks since that horrific shooting happened in Plymouth. But in that time, there have been some 35 mass shootings in America. And we just wanted to examine Britain's relationship with guns, America's relationship with guns, and will anything change? So that's our big thing that's coming up on the episode today. But first, as ever, it's our columnist panel. No night at the Marriott this week. Indian night is off. Everyone's having a spray tan this week. So instead, James Marriott is joined by Olivia Utley from The Telegraph. I suppose we should start with the sort of the big story of the day, the week, the month, the question of Afghanistan. I'll ask you in a moment about how you thought Dominic Raab got on, and this suggestion by Ben Wallace that Britain is no longer a superpower. But let's just take a listen to what Dominic Raab has been saying in the last few minutes at this press conference in Qatar. He emphasised the UK's support for Afghanistan.
Our commitment on the part of the UK to Afghanistan remains. We need to adjust to the new reality, and I think we had good conversations about what that will involve.
Dominic Raab at the press conference this morning. He also confirmed the UK commitment to eligible refugees.
And we will extend a warm welcome and provide haven to those who wish to come to the UK and who are eligible.
That's Dominic Raab speaking this morning. Olivia, what have you made of his appearance at the Select Committee yesterday, then his decision to go to Qatar today? Is he now giving the impression of being in control?
To start, I do feel a little bit of sympathy with Dominic Raab. It wasn't his decision to withdraw from Afghanistan. Once the US had withdrawn in such a messy way, there was nothing else we could really do. So from a sort of macro perspective, he didn't have a huge amount of choice. And I slightly think that I know it was a terrible look that he didn't come back from Crete, but I doubt that it actually materially mattered that much. I'm sure he wasn't just chillaxing. I expect he was taking a lot of calls and not having much fun in Crete. So I do feel a little bit sorry for him. But I think, Tom Tugendhat did a great job sort of one-upping him with his, excellent knowledge of SEO what's the word? It's gotten the word. Initials, what's the word? Anyway, that and, you know, his fantastic knowledge of Afghanistan, his on-the-ground knowledge. He pronounced all of the cities perfectly, and Rab was sort of on the back foot looking a bit all over the place. I think he was quite lucky that Claudia Webb came in with her sort of droning sixth formish questions, and that at least made him look a little bit better. But no, I think he doesn't particularly look like a man in control and sort of rushing off to Qatar. Slightly, I would say, underlines that. It looks a bit like he doesn't quite know what he's doing, though I'm not quite sure what foreign secretary. I think his failings are mostly sort of optical rather than deep base. But I think that it's quite possible that he loses his job because, you know, the government needs a scapegoat on this, and he's sort of offering himself up as a scapegoat with these basic mistakes.
I suppose the question is, if your defence is, it doesn't make any difference whether I'm here or not, it's not the most ringing endorsement of your role as Foreign Secretary and Deputy Prime Minister. The other really striking thing, and this is where it sort of moves slightly beyond just Dominic Raab personally, James, is this sort of dispute, public dispute, between him and Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, as to who was to blame and was it intelligence. And it seems very unlikely that both of them can survive in this government, because they seem to be barely on speaking terms. But this idea of Britain is not a superpower, he's told, this is Ben Wallace in an interview with The Spectator. He says, it's obvious that Britain's not a superpower. I think it really goes to what the definition of a global power is. But a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It's certainly not a global force, it's just a big power. So he's almost suggesting there that America's not a superpower. Does it matter whether or not Britain and America are superpowers?
Well, I was kind of amazed that anyone thought Britain still might be a superpower. I kind of thought we got over that after the Suez crisis, but clearly we're still obsessing about it. No, I mean, I think there are two superpowers, and they're China and America. And I think if you start expanding the term much beyond that, it becomes a bit meaningless because, you know, to compare the kind of geopolitical influence, the economies, the military spending, the kind of ability to sort of influence other countries' affairs of China and America with China and America compared to anyone else, it's a completely different thing. And if we're a superpower as well as China and America being superpowers, then we kind of just need another word for proper superpowers, you know, like superpowers or something.
Super duper powers.
Yeah, it's sort of strange. I don't know. Am I alone in this? I just had no idea that we thought we were still a superpower. I thought we just had accepted that we weren't, but I mean, maybe I'm on my own on this.
Olivia, my sense is that the political establishment, the Westminster establishment, maybe certainly people in the Conservative Party, still liked to regard Britain as a superpower. That actually, you know, Brexit, global Britain, Britannia rules the waves again. That's all still, you know, a thing that stirs a certain Tory heart. Olivia, we've lost you again. Have we? No, we'll get her back. But I think there's still an element of that within the Conservative Party.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a kind of bit of a patriotic myth. And I'm sure maybe even if you don't really think Britain's a superpower, you're aware that it's a bit defeatist to say that we're not. And for the purpose of keeping up appearances, you know, it would be a bit unpatriotic to pretend that we weren't. Therefore, everyone has to kind of collude in this idea that we still are. But it just seems so strange. I mean, I don't really know what trappings of a superpower we have apart from the kind of, you know, the fact that we have, you know, our sort of the various sort of trappings of a global power that we acquired at the end of the Second World War when we were, and those sort of symbolic feelings. But I just think the global order has changed, you know.
I genuinely don't know, you know, you definitely get it, obviously, when you go to America, there's flags around, whether other countries go around thinking they're superpowers or if they just do their thing where, you know, where they are and don't feel the need to swagger about the place.
I mean, I think it's just, sorry.
Olivia, I think we've got you back.
Hello, yes, you have. Sorry, I'm not sure what happened there, I didn't hear the whole of your question.
It's the curse. We were slightly talking about how this idea of Britain being a superpower still, James doesn't think, is surprised anyone thought we were. I was just sort of saying, well, actually, within the Conservative Party, especially, global Britain, Royal Britannia, the trade yacht, all of that stuff, likes to feed into the idea of, you know, return to empire and all that sort of business. It does still stir a certain part of the Conservative Party. But I was also just wondering whether or not other countries go around even thinking about this, or they just, you know, does Denmark or South Africa or, you know, do other countries worry about their place in the world quite as much as we do?
I think you're definitely right that there's a certain part of the Conservative Party, the sort of Peter Bones of the world, who do see Britain very much as a global police power and sort of don't really like the idea of working together with other, you know. I think the consensus now really is what Ben Wallace says, that, well, the future is Britain working bilaterally and trilaterally, et cetera, with other countries, because our military, we don't have the money, and also it doesn't really seem worth building up our military so much that we could be a global superpower. That doesn't seem particularly good use of people's taxes. As for whether other countries worry that much about their standing in the world, I would say probably Denmark and South Africa, no, not particularly. But I think that Macron is very concerned about whether France is a global superpower. And I think there are a couple of other countries like that. So I don't think it's a unique quirk of that side of the British Conservative Party necessarily.
Yeah, I think maybe you're right. Maybe you are right. Yeah, Macron is definitely sort of swimming in that pool. James, your column that you wrote this week was about bank holidays. And it's a sort of it's a bank holiday tradition that somebody will come out and call for more bank holidays. I think, was it the TUC came out and said that we should have more bank holidays? And you're in full agreement. You are the Jeremy Corbyn.
I am. Yes. Yeah. This week I am. It's always kind of seemed fairly obvious to me. The should be more bank holidays column that's written every time this year. Says that, oh no, we've got this sort of dreary stretch, you know, until Christmas and no bank holidays, gloomy winter with no respite. And I sort of just wanted to go into the kind of history of it all, because I think it's sort of fascinating to remember the kind of British tradition of holidays. And if you sort of go back basically to the 15th century, there were sort of public holidays, religious festivals all the time. So I think the average average working year in the 15th century was about 250 days, which is slightly less than what we do today. And then over the 17th and 18th centuries, we lost all these holidays. I mean, all these fantastic traditions. There's a tradition called Saint Monday, which was a sort of medieval and sort of 15th, 16th century thing where workers would quite commonly take off the first Monday of a week if they fancied it, sleep off their hangovers. And that was a sort of accepted workplace thing, which it really isn't anymore. We began to get bank holidays again in the 19th century, which is kind of paradoxical because we think of the 19th century as this era of dark satanic mills and fumes and abused workers and stuff. And there's all kinds of fascinating evidence which people at the 19th century at the time were saying, which is that there's a particular benefit to taking a holiday as a nation. There are all kinds of these benefits for national unity. People are happier. There's a really interesting study in Sweden that showed that people are happier on holidays the more other people are taking holidays simultaneously, which I sort of think just sort of makes sense. You know, if you're in the streets on a bank holiday, there is that kind of atmosphere there. And I just think as a society, as we're more and more atomized, as we're increasingly working from home, as people's working time is much less synchronized, the more we can sort of do something together as a society, which is very unlikely now to be, you know, religious festivals, the more we can have a communal sense of something going on, which I think happens on bank holidays, the better. And that's why I think there should be more.
That's the case for Olivia. Where do you stand on them?
Well, yeah, I actually entirely agree with James.
Sorry about that.
But I think, yeah, I'm going to say what the other side is, which, you know, you hear quite a lot of people, and I think probably quite a lot of my colleagues would say this, but that the bank holidays are taking, you know, we're much less productive if we had more bank holidays. I just think that's a ridiculous myth. The idea that sort of every hour that employees are in work, they're working really hard, is rubbish. And it's very clear, you know, the idea that if you get in at 9:30, then you're doing less work than if you get in at 9. I mean, that's not necessarily true at all. You probably work much harder and much smarter because you know you've got a bit less time. And I think the point James made about once you've been sort of refreshed and regenerated, you'll probably do the work, is definitely true. I also think, I mean, I was in York over the bank holiday weekend. There are a lot of people in York over the bank holiday weekend. They're just pouring money into the economy. Like, what an amazing pickup for pubs and restaurants and shops, etc., which, especially now, obviously desperately need our help. And it seems pretty obvious that also I do just quite like bank holidays. I love the idea of the St. Monday to sleep off your hangover.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. We went to a circus on Monday. The whole family went, and there was, you know, there were lots of parents and obviously children, and all, but it felt slightly like naughty, but a bit fun. You know, the fact that it was a Monday and we were at the circus because it was a bank holiday, It just felt...
It's brilliant, and such a traditional British way of spending it. The historian Robert Toombs had this great... in his book, The English and Their History, which I really recommend, he has this fantastic sort of riff on the democratic spirit of the English bank holiday. And it's all about the seaside and about festivals and about getting drunk and getting into fights. I mean, maybe we don't think all those things are necessarily positive, but he sort of sees it as this great sort of populist, democratic celebration, which he thinks is a kind of a nice corrective to the sort of the Victorian middle class's disapproval of leisure and obsession with hard work and stuff. And it's sort of, and this sort of deep British tradition of just having proper fun. I mean, I was actually working on Bank Holiday Monday, so I wasn't participating. I didn't fight anyone or get drunk.
We'll discuss on another day whether or not what you do is actually work. Olivia Utley and James Marriott. Then, of course, you can read James in the Times of the Week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, we're going to talk guns.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Now, it's been 3 weeks since a gunman in Plymouth opened fire and killed five people before turning the gun on himself. The last time the UK had such a deadly mass shooting was more than a decade ago when Derek Bird killed 12 people in Cumbria. But in just the 3 weeks since the Plymouth shooting, there have been 35 mass shootings in the United States of America. It's a pattern which is all too familiar.
I want to begin by saying that Hillary and I are profoundly shocked and saddened by the tragedy today in Littleton, where two students opened fire on their classmates before apparently turning their guns on themselves.
I cried when they wanted to cry. I hugged when they wanted to hug. We just loved them as best as we could. And that's all you can do. And these people were in shock. You know, it wasn't but 24 hours ago that they lost a child, and now they're here trying to deal with it.
I hope and pray that I don't have to come out again during my tenure as president to offer my condolences to families in these circumstances. But based on my experience as president, I can't guarantee that.
This act of evil occurred as the victims and their families were in their place of sacred worship. We cannot put into words the pain and grief we all feel and we cannot begin to imagine the suffering of those who lost the ones they so dearly loved.
I even hate to say it because we're saying it so often. My heart goes out. Our hearts go out for the survivors, who had to flee for their lives and who hid, terrified, unsure if they would ever see their families again, their friends again.
Yeah, time and again, US presidents have had to react to mass shootings in the United States, but very little seems to actually change. So how have two countries, Britain and America, with so much shared cultural history, ended up with such opposing positions on gun ownership? In a moment, we're going to speak to two Americans who now live and work in the UK. But first, we thought we'd check in with Jackie Goddard. She's the Times' Miami correspondent, who's got a personal connection to what's happened with guns in America.
So I've reported on a number of shootings in my 20 years in the US, but there was one that brought things rather closer to home back in February 2018, Valentine's Day. And there was a shooting at my local high school in my community. It ended with 17 people being killed, 14 students and 3 staff, and 17 injured. And I think the difference with this one was that when you're reporting on a shooting or any other kind of a incident or disaster in somebody's community, you move in, you report on it, and in time you kind of drift away from it and might check in from time to time on the aftermath. But this one, every day since, there's been these shifting dynamics in the community. The kind of aftermath that it leaves behind has been interesting. The impacts that you don't see unless you're in that community, the effects on people, the PTSD, this traumatic, post-traumatic stress that a lot of the people who went through this at the school have gone through. Just small things that one has to consider now in the community. Every time there are July the 4th Independence Day fireworks, there are always appeals from families, you know, asking, please bear in mind that every time a firework goes off, every time there's a loud bang, any time there's a siren goes down the street, any time kids hear a fire alarm at their school, there's a sort of jumpiness and edginess that it's left behind, and this stress and trauma. It led to the Parkland shooting, led to a number of legislative changes in Florida, including all schools now have to have what's called an SRO, a school resource officer, which is basically an armed guard, an armed cop at every school. There are mandatory shooter drills, active shooter drills, and the children have to practice once a month, or hiding in the corner or hiding under their desks for in the event that a shooter might enter the school. You can understand that for, you know, fire drills and tornado drills, these sort of natural or somewhat more acceptable risk, but the notion that our kids have to get under their desks once a month and cram into the corner of a classroom or hide in the stationary closet because there might one day be an active shooter in their classroom like there was in Parkland, it just seems so crazy. There was a lot of blame went round. People pointed fingers in different directions, the obvious finger to point being at the shooter, who was a teenager, but former student at the school with mental disturbances, and he's still awaiting trial. There's a lot of debate as to whether he should be tried on a death penalty case or not. So 3 years later, there's still no justice for the victims. And some people blamed the school board, blamed the school superintendent, said the school security hadn't been high enough. People blamed the sheriff's department, that the deputies hadn't done enough. There was a lot of blame that went round. There was a lot of political divisiveness. Some of the parents of students involved, some were pro-gun, still are, amazingly, and some became gun reformists and became very prominent voices calling for gun reform and gun control. Nobody has said get rid of guns altogether in America. That's a stretch, basically, trying to get that ever done. But getting semi-automatic weapons off the streets really shouldn't be a stretch. And yet somehow in America it is. I think I'm always baffled by this dynamic of how accepted the gun culture is in America and how difficult it is really to effect reform, and that even after this massacre, with kids dead in school hallways, you know, running down the hallway with their backpacks on, being shot in the back, that if even that isn't going to do the trick, I really don't know what will. I don't see a political will there, or enough political will to change anything. And there is a public will, but it's pretty, again, politically divided. And after the Parkland shooting, there was a big movement began that was founded by some of the students at that school. They founded an organisation called March for Our Lives. They were very effective at being heard and at being punchy and outspoken, and getting up on podiums and speak and gathering a million people in Washington, D.C., to protest for gun reform. And over time, really, their voice has faded. They're still there. They're still working away doing their work. But there's been this acceptance that change isn't going to come quickly, if it's going to come at all. A couple of weeks ago, one of my kids started as a student at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where the massacre occurred. And the building in which the shooting happened, it's a standalone building as part of the school grounds, which are made up of a number of different buildings and units. And that building is set to be demolished because it's not somewhere where the memories of what happened and the awfulness of what happened can really be, you know, scrubbed away and forgotten. So that building is a condemned building, but it's fenced off to somehow screen it. Or you can't really screen a very tall building. So it's there, there's this constant reminder. And it's been left standing for now, for the last 3 years, because it is a crime scene. And because the trial of the alleged shooter still has not occurred, that crime scene cannot be destroyed in case a jury wants to go and visit it during the trial for any reason. So this thing stands there looming over the school grounds, and everybody has to kind of sort of move around it, and it's sort of, you know, the elephant in the room. There's this constant reminder of what occurred. There's a memorial garden there that now students get to work on, to dig and plant flowers and put little painted stones down. There's an annual day of remembrance for the victims of the shooting, where all schools get a half day and the rest of the day is sort of dedicated to children going off and doing community service, or you know, helping out in their community some way, or just having a quiet time of reflection. So really, it's, you know, the way that the children have for years to come, even children that were not at the school at the time, are sort of get to still remember and commemorate and memorialise what occurred. It's kind of interesting to see. My own kids are forever baffled by the gun culture in America. They are Americans themselves. But, you know, the hunting, shooting and fishing culture is one thing, and guns are a part of that. But this idea that one should carry a gun in one's back pocket, or that you can even own a sort of weapon of mass destruction, or a firearm that would otherwise usually be seen only on a battlefield, is something that I can never explain to my kids, and they can't explain either.
That was Times Miami correspondent Jackie Goddard giving her reflections on America's relationship with guns, but particularly the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting, which happened on February the 14th, Valentine's Day in 2018, in which 17 people were killed. Up next, we're going to discuss more about that culture, but with two Americans who now live in the UK, Greg Swenson from Republicans Overseas and Morgan Schollmeyer from the Adam Smith Institute think tank. We'll do that next.
Tom Newton-Dunn, Sunday morning from 10 on Times Radio. In the no political analysis and industrial strength debate.
If Joe Biden knew this collapse was imminent, why then didn't he change course?
With a top quality lineup of guests and commentators.
Some of the actions we've taken are already starting to bear fruit.
Reviewing the week in politics from Westminster and beyond.
People across the political divide, if you like, uniting to say this should not and cannot have happened on our watch.
Tom Newton-Dunn, Sunday morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio with GoDaddy, providing all the help and tools you need to grow your business online.
Nice to be with this, Matt Chorley on Times Radio. Now, we're discussing gun crime, the gun culture in America. We were just struck that it's been 3 weeks now since that terrible incident in Plymouth, where five people were killed by a gunman before turning the gun on himself. The last time, it's been something like 10 years since we had such a serious mass shooting in the UK, thank goodness. But in the time since the Plymouth shooting, there have been 35 mass shootings in the USA alone in just the last 3 weeks. And it's one of those things, we have so many similarities between Britain and America, and we think we're, you know, so alike in many ways. But it's the thing that Brits find most baffling. Well, let's speak to two Americans who live in the UK and see if they can explain it to us. Greg Swenson is from Republicans Overseas. Hi, Greg.
Hello, Matt. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you with us. And Morgan Schottemeyer from the Adam Smith Institute. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, Matt.
Greg, first of all, explain where and abouts in America you're from. Where did you live before you came to the UK? And just the explain as best you can the gun culture in that area.
Yeah, happy to do it, Matt. And again, thanks for having me. I grew up in New York, in the suburbs of New York, in Huntington, Long Island. Now, I'm not really much of a gun culture place. I think, you know, partly because gun laws have been so strict in New York and other states like it. But I think it's also some cultural issues. There's really no notable hunting in that area. And also, you know, as you all know, that, you know, the culture of guns is much more prominent in the South and in parts of the Midwest where you have more of a hunting culture in many ways. I also spent most of my adult life in Chicago, where the gun laws are also very strict. But we've been suffering for generations, gun violence in certain parts of Chicago. And also, we've also experienced a spike just in the last year or so. And so we see, you know, in spite of not coming from a gun background, except for my brothers being in the military and my grandfather was a New York City policeman. But, you know, from in a time where, you know, the only time he drew his gun was to shoot a horse with a broken ankle is a story he always told my brothers. And so, I can't say I understand the gun culture personally. I do support the Second Amendment, but it's not something that's part of my background. But I've seen it up close and personal living in Chicago.
When you say you mentioned the Second Amendment, just people who don't know, explain the Second Amendment to the American Constitution.
The Second Amendment is the part of the Constitution that protects gun rights, protects the right to own a firearm in the U.S.
Let's bring in Morgan Schottemeyer now. Morgan, same question to you, really. Whereabouts in America are you from originally? What's your understanding of the gun culture?
So I'm from just over the road from Greg. I'm from the shoreline of Connecticut. So basically the same upbringing, not big gun culture. No hunting, no, open carry laws or anything like that. So guns were not in my face growing up. I went to university in Florida and my parents now live in North Carolina. So whenever I go home, I do go home to that like typically Southern state where there are people with guns. Open carry is a thing. You can, you know, you ask any person and they'll tell you about their guns. So people who have guns love guns. I've never, you know, come across anyone in my life growing up who had that affinity. But as soon as you go down south, and this is going to sound super stereotypical, but stereotypes are sometimes based in fact.
And I suppose, but it's also a good reminder that this is not all of America. It's certain parts of America where there is more of this culture. And being in the UK, do you get, Morgan, people asking you about this a lot, about what the hell is going on in America? Why don't you just ban, you know, and when we've had sadly some of these incidents in the UK before, you know, gun controls were tight, particularly after Dunblane. Why don't you just ban them? An obvious way of reducing not having 35 incidents in the last 3 weeks is to have fewer people who've got guns. Do you get asked about that all the time, as if it's sort of slightly your responsibility?
Oh, absolutely. One thing you learn as an American living abroad is you are a representative for all of the rest of America. So I get asked this quite frequently. And as Jackie mentioned in the intro, I was subject to active shooter drills when I was in school in the early 2000s. We had to practice getting away from the windows, barring the door, and all of that. So when I say that to my friends here in the UK, they're dumbfounded that that is actually something that I grew up with. And you mentioned Dunblane. So where I'm from, Connecticut, is the home of our own Dunblane, Sandy Hook. And Jackie alluded to this in her introduction. Sandy Hook was a situation where a active shooter went into an elementary school and killed 26 people, 20 of whom were children, first and second graders, so 5-6 years old. And not much changed. Nothing changed on the national level. Almost nothing changed state level after Sandy Hook. And I sit here and think, as Jackie said, if school children being shot in their classroom isn't impetus enough to change the gun laws, what is?
And I suppose that's the thing. So what is it that's stopping it changing, Greg? Somebody's messaged in, Ollie in Bedford says, could you ask your American guests if they think the NRA, which is obviously the National Rifle Association, is the main blocker of sensible gun reform needed to curb mass shootings in America? If military grade weapons and sensible background checks could be implemented, surely this would help massively. What is it? Because it's, you know, we see knee jerk political responses to much less significant events where thing happens and politicians say, right, we're going to clamp down on that, or we're going to do such and such. This doesn't seem, and that the montage of US, there were so many cases of US presidents paying tribute, sounding sad in the wake of mass shooting, but nothing seems to happen. What is the block, and what is the power of the NRA?
Well, it's a great question, Matt, and I appreciate Morgan's sentiments. You know, I was happened to be in Connecticut during the Sandy Hook shootings, a few miles away at the time when I lived there, and those are particularly, you know, heart, you know, just wrenching moments, and I think that's why you see so much political rhetoric after it. And then you wonder, you know, why isn't there, aren't there changes? I know Governor Rick Scott, who's now a senator, implemented some new restrictions after the shooting in Parkland, Florida. And Morgan brings up a good point. I don't think, in spite of Connecticut being a very, you know, Democratic, very blue state, there wasn't much of a change after Sandy Hook. And I think part of it is, like any really divisive issues, everybody digs into their sides, right? So the NRA is afraid that if they give an inch on something like, you know, assault weapons, you know, that the left will take a mile, and all of a sudden we'll be talking about banning guns, and that will, you know, freak everybody out who owns guns and likes guns. And I agree, by the way, with Morgan that people that have guns really love them. And even my friends in the North, you know, especially with the increase in crime and the reduction in policing, you know, they're nervous and they just want to have their right to defend themselves. But the you know, that when you see these school shootings, it's horrible. But I also remind you that, you know, a lot of these mass shootings, you mentioned 35 incidents recently, Matt, you know, those are shootings, aside from school shootings, which are tragic, obviously, they're usually shootings in the inner city involving children. Three children died in Chicago last weekend. So, you know, we have to look at what's causing these homicides, and it's probably more the reduction in policing, the so-called defunding police movement, as well as the DAs that are instituting bail reform, you know, these Soros-backed DAs that have cut back on prosecuting lesser crimes, but also releasing people. So a lot of the gun violence in Chicago right now are recently released felons that aren't being prosecuted properly by the DAs. And that's been a big issue. So, you know, I don't know that where there's ever going to be a moment where guns will be just illegal. It's something that just doesn't gain any support. And in spite of the, you know, the excitement or the, you know, the tragedies of these school shootings, you know, I think there was a lot of finger pointing. And if you look at Nicholas Cruz, who was the shooter in Parkland, you know, there were some obvious issues with him. He should never have been allowed in school, you know, whether or not you're for gun control or not. There's other issues that, you know, that lead to these things. And again, I'm not advocating that everybody should walk around with a gun, but, you know, a lot of this stuff is because of overlooking a lot of these issues with people like Nicholas Cruz, as well as the fact that policing has been reduced and prosecutions have been dramatically reduced in these cities. And that's why we've seen the spike in homicides in Chicago and other cities in the last year.
So is it basically the case, Morgan, that nobody could become U.S. president running on a ticket of gun controls? Is that basically partly because of the way the system works, and you need to win in so many different parts of the country, and as you were saying, it's more concentrated in different areas, and as a result, political expediency wins the day ultimately?
Yeah, the original question is about how powerful the NRA is. The NRA is incredibly powerful. It's the most powerful lobby in the US. They have millions and millions and millions in a war chest, and they fund pro-gun candidates. And that is incredibly influential when it comes down to it. How much money you have access to is incredibly influential. And those politicians are never going to change their stripes because of how much money the NRA gives them. I'd like to pick up on something Greg just said about how the shooter in Parkland was clearly mentally ill and should not have been allowed in the school. I think the most important thing is he should not have been allowed access to a semi-automatic rifle. So I'm sure that was, you agree with that, but I would just like to point out that the issue here isn't necessarily about, it is also about mental health provision and making sure that we're taking care of vulnerable people in our society, but also about some basic due diligence when it comes to access to guns. A lot of states don't require any background checks at all. You can buy a semi-automatic rifle at Walmart. There was a shooting in Texas where a man went into a Walmart with a semi-automatic rifle and killed several people. I had a lot of British people ask, how did this happen? How did no one raise the alarm? It's because you can walk around Texas with a semi-automatic rifle on your back. That's legal. So these sorts of things are just completely unnecessary. You can protect the Second Amendment and have right to access arms, but the idea that we wouldn't even do a background check, the idea that you can carry a loaded semi-automatic rifle on your back in the streets, these are unrealistic, unnecessary provisions that we could easily get rid of. Not easily, but we should get rid of. And you can still protect the right to the Second Amendment for hunting, fishing, self-defense, all of that.
So just finally then, do you think there will ever be a time when a US president might get a grip on this issue? Or is it just an accepted part of life that this is one of the things that happens in America and it doesn't even really make the news a lot of the time because it's just a part of life? Is it just the price that you pay? Somebody texted in saying the majority of Americans care more about their guns than about the hundreds of children left dead by their use. Is that fair, Greg? Is there ever going to be a time when a president might tackle it?
Well, I think we have one right now who's very much a gun control advocate. I don't think it will ever fly in Congress because of some of the points that Morgan and I agree on, that, you know, it's not something that has ever been embraced by the population. And look, that you'll see in the midterm elections, for example, in 2006 and 2018, the Democrats had great success by running pro-gun or at least pro-Second Amendment candidates. And then when they get into Congress, you know, you'll hear a lot from the far left or the progressives about gun control. But that's what usually when they do better in elections is when they have a more balanced candidate. So, and I think I think the other reason it's never going to fly, even with a pro gun control candidate, I mean, a president like Biden, it's, you know, look, these mass shootings are tragic, but they're happening in inner cities right now. They're not happening at schools. And maybe the schools get more attention, but you know, the U.S. is 4.6% of the world population, only 1% of the world shooters. If you look at France, Finland, Norway, and some of the Eastern European countries, they have a higher per capita death rate from mass shootings than the U.S., and yet they have much stricter gun laws. And Morgan mentioned that the states that, you know, some have more strict rules than others, and it's the states with the more strict gun control that has the more of the gun violence problems. It's not always correlated. And that's, you know, it's unpleasant to say, but, you know, I think just having some statistics are important.
And that's why we wanted to have you on. Just quickly, Morgan, can you ever see a situation where a president might grasp this?
Unfortunately not, unless they control the House and the Senate and have the, you know, the gumption to do it. I don't see it happening. You can't do it if you don't control both the House and the Senate. It would just never pass.
Well, it's been fascinating, if slightly depressing, but I think it's an interesting, I'm really pleased we've been able to discuss it and get your take on it. Morgan Schondemeyer from the Adam Smith Institute, Greg Swenson from Republicans Overseas, thanks so much for joining us on Times Radio. And I just thought, one of the most depressing things, when we were sort of looking to this and reading all the statistics of just how many mass shootings there are in America, As well as all those clips of the president at the beginning, I just thought we'd just play out on this. Probably sums up the powerlessness, it seems, of US presidents. Of when this was back in 2015, when US President Barack Obama was delivering a eulogy at the service for the church leader, Clementa Pinckney, who was among nine people shot dead in the city of Charleston. And the US president, supposedly one of the most powerful men in the world, was just reduced to singing.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved.
We'll see if it ever changes. We'll see if it ever changes, although it wasn't a particularly optimistic conversation there with Greg and Morgan. And thanks to Jackie Goddard, too, our correspondent in Miami. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.